This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. 13 people are dead after a late-night shooting at the Borderline Bar and Grill in Thousand Oaks, California, a town about 40 miles west of Los Angeles. This morning, Ventura County Sheriff Jeff Dean described what the bar looked like in the wee hours.
It's a horrific scene in there. There is blood everywhere, and the suspect is part of that.
Sheriff Dean identified the suspect as 28-year-old Ian David Long, who allegedly entered the bar with a .45-caliber handgun around 11:20 p.m. local time. Among the victims is Sheriff Sergeant Ron Helis, a 29-year veteran of the department. He was just a year away from retirement. Witnesses told CBS Los Angeles that there were about 200 people in the bar at the time that the shooting started.
And then all of a sudden, you hear like the bang-bang of the gunshot, and it just started going crazy. Like, everyone just dropped down to the floor, and then we couldn't get out because the shooting was on that side. So then our friends got the bar stools, and they started slamming against the window so we could get out.
We're going to spend some time today talking about the effects of these mass shootings on our civil society. And listeners, as we do that, we want to hear from you. How are you reacting to the news of this latest one, coming less than 2 weeks after a shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, where a gunman killed 11 people? Do shootings like this make you rethink going to church or temple? What about a bar or a public concert? And if so, do you worry about what that means for us as a society? You can give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. And let's begin with a report from Thousand Oaks. At the teen center there in California in Thousand Oaks is Katie Zesma. She's my former neighbor in the Washington Post newsroom, and she's a national correspondent for the Post. Katie, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, Cal. Thanks for having me.
Just begin, Katie, if you would, by describing the scene in Thousand Oaks right now. What's going on? What are you seeing?
So right now I'm outside the teen center, and it's where families are being notified. And it is just a heartbreaking scene. People are crying and being consoled. They're being notified here as to whether a family member was killed or not inside the bar. So it's just absolutely heartbreaking. You're seeing people, you know, learning that their loved ones were just killed, and they're praying, they're consoling each other, as they're learning this news.
We have some tape from a father who's in exactly the situation you're describing there, Katie. His name is Jason Kaufman, and here he is talking about his son, who he says was inside the Borderline Bar and Grill when the shooting took place.
You all know that I was been here fighting for him all morning long. And we did just get the news that he was one of the 11 that were hit and killed last night.
Tell us his name.
His name was Cody Kaufman. My firstborn son. Oh, son, I love you so much. Oh, heaven.
And Katie, earlier today, Mr. Kaufman was telling reporters that he was using an app to track his son's phone. He could see that it was still in the bar and not moving. And Katie, I think his parents, we can only imagine what he's going through.
Absolutely. And I was there when he spoke, and it's absolutely heartbreaking. He could barely speak. You know, he spoke, he and Cody were best friends, he said, and he coached his baseball team, and they went fishing, and he has he leaves behind two very young brothers and a sister who is due to be born at the end of the month.
Katie, I understand that the suspected gunman, Ian David Long, was among the 13 found dead at the scene. What have we learned about him in the hours since the shooting?
He was. The sheriff's department said earlier this morning that they believe he may have killed himself. What we know about him is that he was in the Marine Corps. We know that he had prior contact with police earlier this year. The police came to his home to check on his well-being to see if he may, be taken in a 5150 hold, which here in California means that you can be taken into protective custody if you are a danger to yourself or others. And the people on the scene decided that he did not fit that criteria, so he was not taken in for that hold. He said other very, very minor interactions with law enforcement. They said, as a car accident and a traffic infraction. So that is what we know. That is what we know of him so far. And obviously, we'll learn a lot more today.
And Katie, what have authorities said might happen next in the investigation? What kind of questions are still outstanding in your mind?
I think most of them are outstanding at they don't know the motive yet. They don't know what caused him to do this, why he chose this bar. That is all things, it's a very, very active investigation, and that's all things that the authorities are trying to figure out right now.
All right, that's Katie Zesma, national correspondent for The Washington Post. Katie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So there's still a lot we don't know about this particular mass shooting, but one of the things that stands out to us today at Radio Boston is this idea. Do shootings like this one have you rethinking the way that you interact in public spaces? You can give us a call at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. It's that very question we began talking about this morning, posed by our own Radio Boston producer, Zoe Mitchell, and she joins us in the studio. Hi, Zoe.
Hey, Callum.
Can you just give us a little sense of what your thought process was? You know, we have another one of these awful headlines as we all wake up this morning, and what was sort of the question that was running through your head?
So, yeah, you know, after reading the news this morning and hearing that report and that those families is devastating, but I was thinking kind of about how, you know, in these past 2 weeks alone, we've seen coverage of these shootings at a house of worship in Pittsburgh, a yoga studio in Florida, and now a bar, you know, in California. And it's just kind of piling on to the places that, you know, I feel like I can't go or we can't go and feel safe anymore. You know, on Tuesday, someone I follow on Twitter was writing about her polling place and a folding table there collapsed in this crowded room. And she said that noise startled everyone to think, you know, someone was there shooting up the polling place. And it just piles on in a way, you know, and it's something that shouldn't happen. And, you know, after today, I feel like now it's like another place I can't go. It just adds to that list. Like I can't even go to a bar and enjoy a drink with my friends. It's something I would love to do, you know, on weekends. And I can't do that anymore and feel safe.
Well, I think the polling place anecdote is so timely. And we have a caller who's sort of speaking to that point. Ashley from Watertown is calling in. And Ashley, I understand that you had second thoughts about voting on Tuesday for fear of this very reason.
For taking my call, that was one of the first things that went through my mind was I told my husband, I said, you know, it'd be good if I could vote earlier, cast a mail-in ballot because I'm worried about what might happen on Thursday. You know, something crazy could happen. And, you know, it was just crazy. That's the type of society we live in where I have to think that. And it's true. Anytime we have some national event, I have to go, oh, what crazy is going to come out of the woodwork? And I just had my first child about 5 months ago, and, you know, I was telling the person who answered the phone, you know, this is the type of stuff I'm going to have to teach her. I'm going to have to teach her to think about these things. Like, well, when you go to vote, you might have to, it'd be safer to do mailing because you never know. And it's like, I just can't believe, you know, I also teach other children, and I went to go teach them, and they're mom had the I voted sticker on, and she said, oh, it'd be good, you know, I took my kids so they can see. And I thought, yeah, I have memories of going to vote with my mom and getting the I voted sticker. I don't know if I'm going to have that with my child, because I'm going to have to tell her to do a mail-in voting because I'm scared for her to walk into a voting booth.
Ashley, thank you so much for the call. And it's, as you said, Zoe, earlier, it's awful that we even have to think about these things. And I think that in the abstract, we've all known for a long time that in theory they can happen anywhere. But the concrete list of locations is getting longer and longer. You know, yoga studios, I'm thinking of the movie theater in Aurora in 2012.
Totally, yeah. And to Ashley's point, yeah, it's like I felt that way for a long time about going to the movies, you know, speaking of what you're saying about Aurora, you know, if anyone stands up or walks across the screen in the middle of a film, I'm immediately on edge. It happened this weekend. I was at The Hate U Give, and some two kids got up and kind of ran across the screen, and I looked over very tense. And I remember 3 years ago, I saw Zoolander 2, which was not a memorable movie at all, but I still remember that night very clearly. It was me and my friend, and a man three rows in front of us was kind of older and alone and acting oddly, like a little off. And I just remember that movie so well because I was thinking, you know, is this it? Is this guy going to shoot up Zoolander 2 right now and this is going to be the end? You know, it's just scary.
Zoe, thanks so much for sharing your thoughts.
Yeah, thank you, Callum.
That's Radio Boston producer Zoe Mitchell. I want to bring in a couple of new voices to the conversation. Joining us on the line now from Normal, Illinois, is Professor Julie Weber. She teaches politics and government at Illinois State University. She's also the author of Failure to Hold, The Politics of School Violence, and Beyond Columbine, School Violence and the Virtual. Hello, Professor Weber.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Dante Ramos, the ideas editor for the Boston Globe. Hello, Dante.
Hi, great to be here.
Dante, let me start with you. As Zoe was just saying, you know, when we think about these mass shootings, we've seen them happen at concerts. We've seen them in churches, bars, nightclubs, movie theaters. How do you see that affecting our civil society?
I think all the evidence suggests that people really want to be together. You know, people want to see other people in live settings. We all, or at least many of us, for those of us who have jobs that end up sitting, you know, have us sitting behind computers at the all day. At the end of the day, you want to go out and see other people. You know, it's sort of a basic human desire. And you even see in sort of war-torn countries like Iraq and Syria, there are still people who go to the marketplace. There are still people who go to houses of worship because they have to. There are reasons that take you out in the public sphere. So I don't think fundamentally that these incidents change that. But I do think, as your caller and your producer pointed out, that it does add to the list of things working against people gathering it in the public sphere. It gives people one more reason to try to interact with people only online rather than in person. And I don't think the evidence suggests that people interacting only online is good for our society.
Professor Weber, why have these places become the targets for shooters? What makes them vulnerable? And is it the very fact that we come there for a sense of community that they are the ideal place to disrupt that sentiment?
I think that's true. I think all of these spaces are spaces of civil society, spaces where people meet and assemble freely. And they come to see other people, as Mr. Ramos said, in person. You know, they don't want to be online all the time. So they are spaces of civil society, which is part of what makes what we call a nation state stable. They keep people happy, and they let us know that the wheels are turning correctly on a country, that we have a civil society. So the fact that they're being attacked and people don't feel safe in them, I think, is very problematic for how we feel about the health of our democracy and how we feel about the health of our country.
Professor Weber, do you see people gathering in those real-world public spaces as they used to, or are we retreating to some degree into our virtual social worlds?
I think many people are retreating, and I think that that's been in some ways sped up by the privatization of what were formerly public spaces throughout the country. So you have, you know, for example, we still go out to sporting events, but the stadiums are owned by corporations, right? And so since we've, as a society, decided to change from public ownership and public use, we've changed to private ownership and private, in some ways, use of many what were formerly public spaces. And so there's less and less of them, and people get less and less practice for being out in them, and they have to be in them in a certain way. I think that's not the traditional way we thought about it under a more public-oriented civil society.
Let's hear from another listener. Matthew is calling from Whitman. Matthew, I understand that despite all these awful headlines, you feel like we just can't allow ourselves to be afraid to go out in public.
Yeah, I think if, first of all, thank you for taking my call. I think if people start staying in or start hiding, it's going to make basically the bad guys win. I think we need to all come together and stop fighting. It doesn't matter what race you are, Democrat, Republican, we're Americans. We need to come together and solve this big issue that we're having. And I think we need to focus more on the mental health situation. There's not a lot of help out there, and there's not a lot of programs out there, I think, for mental health people. And I just think that's a big issue versus putting more laws into place for guns. I mean, there's already a good amount of laws, and they're pretty good laws. And I think we need to get, I think we're kind of stuck on that topic. I think we need to kind of move off that and start focusing on, like I said, the mental health point of view of it.
Matthew, thank you very much for the call. Dante, something Matthew just said struck me. You know, he says, you know, race doesn't matter, but we have seen in some of these mass shootings, sometimes it does. I'm thinking of the shooting at the African-American church in Charleston recently. And of course, we just had that awful shooting less than 2 weeks ago in Pittsburgh that was motivated by anti-Semitism. And yet, on the other hand, some of these shootings, like the most recent one, do seem to be sort of indiscriminate. And I'm wondering whether there's something about these shootings that perhaps can amplify our sense of empathy for one another. I mean, I think we have to be mindful of the fact that, you know, while maybe everyone right now is feeling like it's unsafe to go out into certain public spaces, there are folks, Dante, who are members of historically marginalized groups who have for a long time felt uncomfortable in certain public spaces just because of their identities.
In the aftermath of incidents like these, I think you do see a reaction, as you did after the shooting in South Carolina at the African American church, of people coming out and expressing solidarity and coming forth as a community. Similarly, after the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando, it was something that across the country, shot through the. LGBT community like a bolt of lightning. And, it does sort of create this sense of solidarity. But I think you're right that, if a community feels marginalized already, the existence of these kinds of threats isn't going to make them feel better about the state of society. Just to go back to one thing that the caller said, talking about the difference between laws around guns and mental health, I'm not sure that it necessarily is an either or. And I think that, there's this weird ritual that we are unfortunately evolving where some very disturbed people with relatively easy access to weapons engage in these acts of performative violence. And sometimes it's motivated by race or anti-Semitism or homophobia, or sometimes it's a crazy person wanting to get attention and go out with a blaze of glory. But there's this, this kind of negative vortex that we have created here where, these events happen and they tend to ricochet out into society.
Let's take one more call. Carrie is phoning in from the Back Bay with, I think, a very important question about, Carrie, how on earth do we talk to our children about this? How are you thinking about that right now?
Well, I was born and raised in Portland, Oregon. I remember having a fear of skinheads, and that's because there had been an incident where some skinheads had beaten Ethiopian refugee, I believe, with a baseball bat. And so I just remember going about like my childhood and teen years being afraid whenever I saw skinheads, thinking they might want to beat me with a baseball bat and having that fear. And now I feel like the new normal is, having a fear of massacres. And when I walk around with my kids, I left the site of the Boston Marathon bombing an hour before it happened. And I was going to take my kids there. And now everywhere I go, wherever there's you hear of a mass shooting in the news, like coffee shops or concerts or playgrounds, the visual of a shooting crosses my mind. And my husband, will tell me, you shouldn't walk around being afraid, but I still have that visual because as like the mother bear, I want to protect my kids.
Of course.
So I once heard that these things are like car accidents. You hope it doesn't happen to you, but they happen. And that's how I plan on talking to my kids about it.
Carrie, thank you so much for adding to our conversation. And thank you also to our guests, Professor Julie Weber. She's the author of Failure to Hold, The Politics of School Violence. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you.
Our thanks also to Dante Ramos, the ideas editor for the Boston Globe.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, Eric Fernstrom, the longtime top aide for Mitt Romney, joins us. I'm Callum Borchers, and this is Radio Boston.